Hello, and welcome to the check-in for community connection and conversation over the airwaves. I'm Janet Saidi. Many of us these days find ourselves looking around and asking how we got here to this moment we're in when it comes to disparities in our health, wealth, neighborhoods, education, and justice. How has our history shaped today? Well, one thing we can do is listen to those of us who have lived these experiences over the decades. For Columbia's bicentennial celebrations taking place in 2021, the Como 200 Task Force commissioned KBIA to tell the stories of our African-American history. And with the help of Columbia's Sharpened Heritage Committee, we produced conversations about these histories through the series You Don't Say. Today on The Check-In, we're going to go behind those conversations. And later in the hour, we'll also check in with an MU infectious disease doctor to get his view from the front lines right now. That's next on The Check-In. First, this news. Hello and welcome to The Check-In. Today we're having a conversation behind the conversations that have made up KBIA's You Don't Say series, looking at the Black experience in Columbia historically and what we can make of those stories to make sense of today. With us, we have three longtime and lifelong, in some cases, Columbians who have worked with KBIA to produce this series. First, Ms. Barbara Harrell was born in Columbia and worked for 45 years at MU, largely in recruitment of Black students for the School of Medicine. So obviously, Ms. Barbara Harrell has been involved in conversations going on today for decades. And now she works to preserve Columbia's history with the Sharpened Heritage Committee. She also works tirelessly as an educator and preserving the African-American Heritage Trail here in Columbia. Ms. Barbara Harrell, thanks so much for being with us on The Check-In today, and welcome. It's great to have
you.
Thank you, Ms. Barbara. It's great to have you here. Let me also welcome Mr. Jim Witt. Mr. Witt is also a founding organizer with the Sharpened Heritage Committee. He's also the director of the City of Columbia's Supplier Diversity Program. Welcome, Mr. Jim Witt. Everyone stand by. We might just have a few technical issues that are part of the joy of remote production here. And I think, Mr. Witt, we might have you with us now. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Sorry if we were not hearing you there for a second. We are doing live radio in a pandemic, and sometimes that creates some delays and echoes on our tech side. But our brilliant tech team has got us sorted out now. So, Mr. Witt, Ms. Harrell, thanks so much for being here. You both really helped us not only tell these stories about the African-American experience in Columbia historically, but you also sort of worked with us actually as producers on this to help choose the people and the places we talk with. And we want to hear a little bit from these conversations today. But first, let me ask you both, because you're both involved so much in the Sharpened Heritage Committee and also the African-American Heritage Trail. Let me just start with a really general question for both of you. What do you hope to do with these education efforts about Columbia's African-American history? Ms. Harrell, let's start with you. What do you hope that listeners and some of your people that you're educating, everyone from school kids to KBIA public radio listeners, get from the efforts that you're doing on African-American history? What do you hope people get from this?
My biggest hope and wish is that people understand and become a part of what we're doing and what we've worked hard, that they understand that we are all one people in Columbia, and it takes all of us knowing our history to share it and to be proud of what we're doing here.
That's such a great thing and such an important thing to remember, that it's all of our history, and it's a really exciting history and an often surprising history, and I want to get into some of the specific stories. Mr. Witt, what about you? What do you hope people take away from the work that you're doing with the Heritage Trail and also the Sharpened Committee?
Well, I kind of echo what Barb just said, and also it's really an opportunity for the people of Columbia to learn about the history of Blacks here in Columbia and the accomplishments that Blacks have contributed to our city. It's a history that's being told from the voices of the people who live the history, and I think that's important for us to know that. And it's a great educational piece so that we can include black history and the overall history of Columbia. That makes us a much more diverse and well-rounded and knowledgeable community.
Yes, I think so. And I think hearing that history from the people who have lived the history is really exciting for everyone in our community from all backgrounds, ages. Let me ask both of you another kind of general question. What would you say are the two or three big things that people are surprised by? You both talk a lot about Columbia's African-American history. People of all ages, backgrounds, races that you're coming to in your presentations, what would you say people are surprised by? Ms. Harrell?
Mostly, they are surprised that we had such a vibrant community of blacks in Columbia. You know, only 11% right now of the population of Columbia, they just didn't understand how we did all of that and where we did all of that. In growing up in Columbia, as I tell them often, I grew up on the north side of Columbia, which was largely Ward 1, and everybody was like, oh, okay. So they understand now that we were, even though we were divided and separated in those days, we were still doing things. We were still here, very prominently here, sharing our part of service to the Columbia community also. So I'm just amazed that people didn't know the things that we're sharing with them.
I think that's true. I think there are, I've seen that. I've been with you on some of the school kid presentations and some of the tours, and also you know, sat in depth with you with some of these conversations. And I agree with you. I think that the vibrancy of the history is something that is, and just the individual stories of people like Henry Kirkland and Annie Fisher. And I'd like to get into some of these stories at some point, hopefully, in the next few minutes here on the check-in. What about you, Mr. Witt? What do you think are some of the surprising takeaways what do you see other people being surprised at about our African-American history in Columbia?
Well, I think people are really surprised to know, you know, to learn a lot about the Sharp Inn and the various businesses that were there, and to know that there was a vibrant business community that basically served, you know, the black community during a time where, you know, blacks were prohibited from attending some of the white-owned establishments and things like that, and also to learn the protocols and the history of you know, how people could visit the Sharp Inn. There's some very, very interesting stories there. And you know, a lot of people are surprised at the number of businesses and the types of businesses that were here during the long history of the Sharp Inn business community, you know, from the early 1900s right up through urban renewal.
Right. I think that's right. The Sharp Inn District right there, sort of where the post office is in Columbia, right where the Ready offices are located. And a really so many stories coming out of that Sharp Inn District alone about our African-American history here in Columbia. Let me just remind listeners, you're listening to The Check-In. We're talking about Columbia's African-American history, the stories, the experiences of lifelong Columbia residents, and what we can learn from their stories and experiences. We're talking with Sharp Inn Heritage Committee members and educators, Ms. Barbara Harrell and Mr. Jim Witt. And I'd like to bring in another voice into this mix now. We also have Reverend Clyde Ruffin joining us. Reverend Ruffin is an MU theater professor emeritus, a former Columbia City Council member, and he also serves as the pastor of Columbia's historic Second Missionary Baptist Church. He's been with us a few times before on The Check-In. I'd like to say he's a regular voice on KBIA now. Reverend Ruffin, thanks so much for coming back to join us here on The Check-In.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Reverend Ruffin, you've helped us produce a couple of these conversations, or at least participated in a couple of these conversations with us. And in one of them, you talked about, for you growing up in Kansas City, in a black community in Kansas City, and just sort of what it was like as you walked to school, all the African-American businesses that you walked past. Would you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Kansas City as opposed to Columbia for you?
Well, of course, it's a much more urban setting than Columbia. But I certainly grew up believing that the possibilities in my life were great. My parents at the time were not very educated. My father only went to the second grade. My mother attended adult evening classes at the same time that I was in high school. We both graduated from high school in the same year because of that. She later went on to go to college, but at the time, being able to see all of the black-owned businesses and the homes of my pediatrician and others in our community gave me the simple idea that anything was possible, that I was able to rise above my humble beginnings and achieve and dream for something bigger.
Reverend Ruffin, you spoke, and a lot of your feelings and stories, I think, came out about this a little bit in a conversation that you had. It was a really amazing conversation between you and another pastor, longtime pastor, David Ballinger, who's the pastor of the Log Providence Church. Okay, we will bring that clip up in a little while. We will come back right after this break. We will hear some more clips from the You Don't Say conversations, continue our conversations on Columbia's African-American history. You're listening to The Check-In. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, and welcome back to The Check-In. We're talking about the Black experience in Columbia historically, then and now, and what we can learn from the stories of our African-American history in Columbia going forward. With me here in The Check-In is Ms. Barbara Harrell and Mr. Jim Witt. Both are active founding advocates and educators with the Sharp End Heritage Committee and the African-American Heritage Trail here in Columbia. Ms. Harrell is also a member of the City of Columbia's COMO 200 Task Force. That task force commissioned this series of conversations with KBIA, a series called You Don't Say, in conjunction with the city's bicentennial celebration. So we really appreciate them bringing that idea to us as we explored the history and our African-American history in Columbia. We're also joined by Reverend Clyde Ruffin. Reverend Ruffin is an MU theater professor emeritus, a former Columbia City Council member, and also serves as pastor of Columbia's historic Second Missionary Baptist Church. Sorry, we mentioned a clip. We can go to that clip now. We are talking with Reverend Ruffin about his conversation with another longtime pastor in Columbia, David Ballinger. Let's hear a little bit from that conversation, and then we can talk about it.
You know, you paint a very heartwarming memory of growing up here and the work that you've done and the community that surrounded you. But we know that it has not always been wonderful. Everything has not been glorious and peaceful and nurturing. Can you think of something that you have experienced here in this community that was extremely difficult for you?
When I grew up, the older members in the community owned our houses along 3rd Street. They were not fabulous, but they were there. Most of them had an outdoor facility.
Outhouse.
But if you walk down the road, Switchler, my Maenda was cooking dinner, and you were outside playing, they invited you in. Come on in here. The most disheartening thing was when those areas that were identified, that we identified with, Sharp End, 3rd Street, Urban Renewal came in. And all of those people were promised that they would have a better life. They would be homeowners. And that didn't happen. A lot of the areas that were iconic for us, that we could point at, were gone.
Okay, that was a clip. That's Reverend David Ballinger with the Log Providence Church, a longtime pastor here in Boone County, talking with Reverend Clyde Ruffin, who joins us today on the check-in. Reverend Ruffin, what was going through your mind, and what are your thoughts on Reverend Ballinger's memories, which are sort of, I think, similar to you, describing a very vibrant Black neighborhood that you grew up in?
Well, the thing that it reminds me of is something that I often refer to, which can seem to be controversial, which is that when you live in a segregated community where children are protected and loved and nurtured, very often it is a viable way to build self-esteem, to infuse them with dreams, because they are somewhat isolated from the racism that exists outside of the community. But we also know that it is virtually impossible to stay in that place. Eventually, we have to prepare our children to deal with the injustices and inequities that exist outside of these closed communities. And I experienced the same thing, because when I went to college, I had never actually gone to school with anyone that was not African American. And so I was unprepared to deal with the culture in Iowa City. And so it can be disturbing when we see those things, those institutions and neighborhoods that have nurtured us and comforted us begin to disintegrate. And then where do you go from there?
Ms. Harrell, let me bring you into this, because you've spent your entire life in Columbia, and you also have talked a little bit about the erosion of institutions, and you've worked within one for about 45 years at MU, trying to ease the experience and also bring Black students into MU. And you also went to MU as I think it's the first Black student from Columbia to get a full ride scholarship to MU. So you really have kind of been a pioneer in education from every side of the lectern, really. What do you think about what Reverend Ruffin's talking about, the experience of Black students and just kind of trying to ease their way into white-dominated spaces?
Well, I can personally say, as Pastor said, when we integrated the other system, and we called it the other system because growing up in Columbia on the north side, when I went to the university, it was like there were 23 Black students there, and it was like, okay, this is different. When you are, I compared it, and when I do presentations, I compare it to a bowl of white rice with 23 raisins in it. So we were always on target. Somebody knew us. We did not know them. And so the culture blending was very slow. And as I worked with students during my career at the university, both in veterinary medicine and human medicine, the cultures were something that I had to adjust to, and they had to adjust to myself and the students, because some summers we would have as many as 75 to 100 Black students on campus who were coming predominantly from southern areas or the East Coast, where they saw a lot of diversity or no diversity. And it was very interesting how the two blended or didn't blend. But believe it or not, every 4th of July, we had a big 4th of July picnic for everybody in both schools, and they came. And it was good to see all at once people are talking, asking each other, telling each other. It wasn't doctor this and doctor that. It was so-and-so and so-and-so, and where are you from? And so that's the collaboration that we still are enjoying. Each day, some of us are crossing over to different avenues of intelligence about our different cultures. And sometimes we find we're doing the same things, we just call it different things.
Right.
So it's the great blending of Columbia that I'm excited about, and sometimes I'm still weary about, because, like I say, I grew up, I've been in this place for a long time.
Well, excited and weary sounds, that makes a lot of sense. I hear you on that, and I hear that a lot, I think, from our Black colleagues and friends. There's a lot of you know, hope in this moment, and then also, you know, a lot of weariness and exhaustion in this moment. Reverend Ruffin, we only have you for a couple of more minutes. You have to leave us at about 12:30. So let me ask you, you know, what Ms. Barbara is describing is sort of a lot of joyful 4th of July experiences. You mentioned something when we were having one of our conversations for the You Don't Say series that that a lot of the media and the storytelling tends to suffer, kind of focus on suffering and pain. But there's a lot of joy. There's a lot of vibrancy in these histories. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you mean by that?
Well, when I was working in the theater department with the program that we established, which was originally the Black Theater Workshop and later changed to the World Theater Workshop, and I began to review the available dramatic literature that we could present on stage, I found that so much of the history is recorded in the arts, and it's rooted in pain, and it's rooted in suffering, it's rooted in pointing the finger at our oppressors. And I chose, rather than to spend an inordinate amount of time working on projects of this nature, to seek out projects that celebrated the history and celebrated the achievements and the many wonderful things about African American history and culture in the world, and use those opportunities to encourage and inspire and uplift our people, and to also send a message that we are survivors, we are conquerors, that we are able to achieve in the midst of tremendous adversity. And I think that is an important message that needs to resonate throughout our history, that in spite of the pain, in spite of the difficulties, we are still here, we are still achieving, we are still accomplishing, we're still creating, and we're still contributing in a very vital way to the world in which we live.
All right. Thank you so much, Reverend Ruffin, for sharing that. And thanks for being with us today. I think it's 12:30 and we probably have, do we have to let you go? Do you need to move on now?
I've got just a few more minutes.
All right. Well, then please stay with us. And I will just remind our listeners that you're listening to The Check-In. We're talking about Columbia's African-American history, the stories, the experiences of some lifelong and longtime Columbia residents. Talking with Ms. Barbara Harrell, Mr. Jim Witt, and Reverend Clyde Ruffin, all of whom are experts in the African-American experience and history in Columbia, and have helped us produce these conversations for our You Don't Say series here on KBIA. Ms. Harrell, I want, in some of the conversations, you have described how our place and our geography, just the place of Columbia, is experienced differently for some Black residents. And you are really focusing on the Heritage Trail that really addresses this in a very physical way, and just kind of is addressing this imbalance in a way that we are learning about the spaces and the people created by our African American history. But we do have a clip with you, Ms. Barbara, talking about this sense of place and the trail. Let's hear just a little bit from one of your conversations. You were talking with, I believe, Annell Witt for this conversation.
I always say I grew up north of Broadway. I never crossed Broadway to do anything. I didn't work on that side, and only the Blacks that worked on that side of Broadway worked on, you know, were there working for the university or whatever, were over there, because everything we did was right here. And that's the reason for the historical Black Trail. We want to show you what we had here.
Ms. Harrell, would you talk a little bit more about what you're telling Ms. Annell Witt during that conversation? And I think a lot of people are surprised probably to hear that there's this vibrancy going on, but then on a more negative side, there's some discomfort with certain areas of Columbia. Can you talk us through a little bit of that?
Well, we were comfortable north, as I said, north, because everybody that we knew and the families that we knew were there. We had celebrations. We had doctors. We had lawyers. We had beautiful, wonderful instructors and teachers that were not only your teacher today, Monday through Friday, but Saturday they were a person you saw at the store or that you were next door neighbor to on Sunday morning. They may be your Sunday school teacher. They may be your minister or whatever. And so we were comfortable. We were good with that. We also had the occasion to have inspiration from people like Kirkland and those people that were constantly developing and being phenomenal at what they did, and nobody knew about it except us. We didn't even have to whisper about it, but we all knew about Kirkland. We all knew about Blind Boone. We all knew of those people, and we wanted to share those kinds of people with others. First time I was introduced to the other side, they said, "Well, you all don't have. Where do you all go for a doctor?" And I'm like, "I was born at home, and Dr. Battersby was my doctor. I understand, and he was a doctor of everybody on the black side of town. Then we had Dr. Wiggins, and we had Dr. Reynolds." And they go, "Oh, y'all have that many doctors?" Mm-hmm. So you know, it's just ironic that all of this history was there. And nobody knew it. Oh, they lived, and we point to them now. They lived, Dr. Battersby lived right across from St. Paul Church. Dr. Reynolds and Dr. Wiggins were right there on Providence Road. And they go, oh. So it's the lifelong learning that I was taught at the university, that we are always lifelong learners. And if we tend to do that, we're all going to grow.
Well, and Ms. Harrell, I have seen you stomp through those very roads and past the houses with a whole bunch of school kids following you and tell them the stories and tell them about these spaces and the people. And as you say, you know, a vibrant community of intellectuals and doctors and artists. Reverend Ruffin, you have to leave us here in a few minutes. So can you respond a little bit to the clip from Ms. Harrell?
Yes. Yes, yeah, it's certainly what she speaks about is a universal truth. It's not just in Columbia, but it's everywhere. And we are fortunately living in a time when the larger community is embracing African American history and African American struggle and lifting it into the public consciousness. And so I believe, really, for the first time, the fight to incorporate African American history into the larger history without losing its significance and importance as a separate and individual history has brought us into a very exciting time when we realize that black history is not just in the month of February, but it's everywhere, all around us, on every level, every day. And most of all, that history is not dead. History is alive. History is still being written, and the effects of what happened in the past resonate in the present. And we are all becoming much more aware of that, and there's beauty in that. And so I agree wholeheartedly.
All right. Our history is still being written, and there is beauty in that. Thank you so much. You know, those are fantastic words for us to wrap up with, Reverend Ruffin. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you being here. Mr. Jim Witt, thank you also for joining us today. We hope you'll come back again as well soon.
Most certainly, Anne. I've enjoyed the conversation today.
Thanks, Mr. Witt. And also, Ms. Barbara, thanks so much. We'll see you soon. Thanks for being here.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. So let me just thank again Reverend Ruffin, Ms. Barbara Harrell, Mr. Jim Witt for all of your work with KBIA on the You Don't Say Project. Thanks to all of you as well for joining us yet again on The Check, and we will continue these conversations. And you can hear these conversations at kbia.org. Also, keep a lookout for more conversations and celebrations of our city's African-American history through the COMO 200 Bicentennial Year. That COMO 200 Task Force commissioned these conversations. You can find out more on what they're doing and their celebrations at COMO200.com. We'll be right back. We are going to talk to an MU infectious disease physician, Dr. Hari Raghunath, right after this. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back to The Check-In. I'm Janet Saidi. Thank you for checking in with us today. So we've tried getting on with our lives. We've tried getting back to some kind of normal, but the virus seems to have other plans. Things are not going in a great direction here in Missouri and in Boone County. That's kind of stressful. Missouri is a designated red zone for its rate of coronavirus infections, and in mid-Missouri and in Boone County, cases seem to be on the rise. Meanwhile, today, right this minute, students are arriving in our college towns and at MU to embark on the college experience. Some health professionals in our community are worried about all of this, and it is all kind of stressful. So today is a really good day to check in with MU physician Dr. Hari Raghunath. Dr. Raghunath specializes in critical care, pulmonary disease, and infectious disease, and he has been working for months now on the front lines of this pandemic. Dr. Hari Raghunath, thank you so much for coming to the check-in. Welcome. Dr. Raghunath, are you there with me?
I am.
All right. Thanks. Thanks and welcome to the check-in where we do live by remote to enhance everyone's experience here. It's really nice to have you here because that's what I was saying, Dr. Raghunath. It's kind of a stressful time, but no one has the right to be more stressed out probably than you right now. So we want to hear how things are for you as spending months on the front line. Let me just start with a general question. How are you and the hospital right now managing day to day?
Well, we're relatively doing well.
Okay.
Our caseloads in the hospital have been pretty steady
mm-hmm.
In the medical ICU as well as outside of the ICU where mm-hmm. we admit the designated areas where we admit COVID-19 patients. So we have been relatively doing well overall.
Okay, so that's great to hear. And it looks like you've had a handful, maybe six, I think, a couple of days ago, hospitalizations in Boone County. So that seems manageable to you. Let me just, before I get off from the, because I'd really love to dig in a little bit with you, Dr. Raghunath, with the science and what we know about the virus so far. But before I leave the hospital front and the front lines front, is there anything that you're concerned about? What is kind of your focus? Is there anything keeping you up at night when it comes to the hospital and the ICU and our treatment right now?
Not really, because in the beginning, a lot of uncertainties about the supplies and the PPE, personal mm-hmm. protective equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen since March and April to now, through the different phases of the command center activation that we've seen, we've had a steady supply. We've been really stringent and careful in documenting how many PPEs we've been using and appropriately using them, more for the attending physicians and limiting the use by the learners. So we have certain strategies in place that have kept us within a steady supply of PPEs. We never were crunched on the numbers on the PPE. That's number one. Number
Good.
Two, in regards to beds allocation for these patients, we have a segment that's within the ICU and another segment that's outside of the ICU. And never so far with our clinical management and our research management, we really never outrun our the demand. So we're doing relatively well. So nothing really concerns me.
That's great to hear. And, you know, I painted kind of a dismal picture in the intro just now because cases seem to be on the rise, but hospitalizations are steady for us. To what do you attribute that? Is it an increase in testing?
Most likely, more and more wide availability, as mm-hmm. well as probably because it's open now, there is more and more gatherings. So we are probably seeing more transmission as well, which is not surprising. And we hoped that there might be some seasonal variation, but apparently not. And we are learning that as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
So our hospitalization rates so far within the last 2 weeks when I worked in the ICU, twice it came to, we have 8 beds in one side of the ICU that's separate for COVID-19. Twice we came pretty close to 6 or 7 patients, and we were able to move a couple of patients who improved to the other side. And likewise, we are able to handle the load that we are receiving at a steady pace.
All right. As someone who's treating these patients right there in the ICU, what would you say are some key things that we are learning about the virus at this point? And let me just mention something that's been in the news even yesterday, I believe, or 2 days ago, the University of Florida study that is early, but yet seems to have collected aerosols from the virus at a distance of maybe up to 16 feet in a hospital. What do you think of that study? Is this making us rethink how the virus spreads in indoor spaces? And what generally are we learning that stands out to you?
Absolutely. So the droplet spread and fomites were thought to be one of the important ways how these the viruses spread. Aerosol was in question because probably the ways they collected air samples wasn't tuned enough to isolate the virus particles as much as the University of Florida study did. Mm-hmm. They used a type of a particular equipment that was able to have condensed air along with water, which is normally happens when we all breathe. Our mucosa moistens and humidifies the air, so considered to be more simulating the infective viral particles. So this is the first evidence that came out in more in support of aerosol generation. But I feel reassured because we've been using our PPE stringently in our ICU, and we've cared for so many patients so far. Total in-hospital patients, I think we are across 100 now at MU, a rough number. And within the ICU, I've cared for almost 40 patients. Hmm. And none of us have contracted or known to be positive. Hmm. Some of us might have developed mild symptoms, but really we didn't get affected as direct frontline healthcare providers. That speaks to the strength of stringently following the PPE requirements, and that keeps us safe. So this is adding to the evidence saying that closed spaces are not good, and gatherings within closed spaces are probably something that we should avoid in this situation. So there's more and more strength to that because the places where they sampled it were in the patient's room mm-hmm. who had active disease. Mm-hmm. Out, when you have good ventilation, then you have to factor in how many exchanges are happening. The study, when they the setting in which they did, those rooms had, they were not full negative pressure rooms. There were 6 exchanges per hour, which is half of what a full negative pressure rooms are, which is how we also manage patients in the ICU once they are intubated, because their airway and airlines are covered and controlled in a more controlled environment. So there is a message, there is a learning point from the study, but mm-hmm. how does it ramify in the future in regards to the guidelines from the CDC and WHO? We'll have to wait and see. We have to yes. see more and more consistently what more evidence comes up.
Okay, so I hear what you're saying. So that is sort of inductive evidence from that study. But again, when we say it was seems to have been collected, you know, within 16 feet, it still right. doesn't really say what the impact is, does it, on individuals? So there's no reason to panic any more than we already are necessarily. But Dr. Raghunath, I have to say, when you say that you've looked after 40 patients, you haven't seemed to contract anything. I just can't tell you how wonderful that is to hear at this point from you. Let me just remind our listeners, this is The Check-In. We're talking with MU physician Dr. Hari Raghunath. We're talking about his work on the front lines of healthcare during this pandemic, caretaking our COVID patients here in Boone County, what we have learned about the virus, treatments, and the way forward. Dr. Raghunath, what about treatments? You are, as you say, looking after, you know, dozens of patients, not at one time, but over the last few weeks. And I imagine the protocols for how you're treating COVID-19 as a physician is changing, and it's changing at a time when there are research studies and information coming at you all the time. How do you balance all the research and the information with your protocols in the actual ICU?
So the management, it's primarily severe pneumonia or mm-hmm. acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, requiring patients to be on the ventilator. In the early part of the pandemic, we didn't have any evidence towards any particular drug having an effect. Now we have at least 2 or 3 options that are at least proven to be safe and show some benefit in terms of mortality and the time to discharge or the speed at which they recover. Number one is an antiviral drug, remdesivir. Mm-hmm. Number two is a steroid, which is dexamethasone. And number three is plasma. And primarily, these are the 3 options that we use in our in our hospital. Plasma is available still as a part of a clinical trial via its FDA regulated clinical trial with the Mayo Clinic lead. We are a participating site and we offer them as early as possible. How soon do we give them? The earlier the better. Right now, these treatments are reserved for hospitalized patients who require oxygen. The antiviral drug is only IV, so we won't be able to give it to anybody, and it's not recommended to be given to anybody with milder symptoms who is being discharged home. So we have certain criteria as a part of protocol in our hospital. A few options available. Prior to this, majority of our treatment approaches were related to supportive care, to just wait it out until body develops immunity. And once our patients get intubated, some of our patients, a third of our patients, recover within 2 weeks. A third take up to 3 to 4 weeks, and another third of patients go longer. They have more comorbidities. It takes sometimes 6 weeks, 7 weeks, requiring tracheostomy and prolonged weaning from the ventilator.
Have you been able, Dr. Raghunath, to see those numbers improving over the last few weeks? It's really been a very short time, but as you said, these three main frontline treatments that you are able to work with, are they improving the outcomes for your patients?
Well, I would say it depends on the immunological biotype and phenotype of the particular patient and how deranged his body systems are. So severity of illness at the time of presentation determines their outcome more so. So far, the trials are the only go-to place for me to say there is benefit. In our patients, the rate of recovery has been steady and the same at any given point in time. If there are markers of very severe disease, those patients some don't make it. And this, we see it even in influenza and other respiratory viruses. So for us, we are seeing a larger proportion of COVID-19 patients who get admitted develop more severe respiratory disease. We kind of see a similar picture for influenza, but the severity in COVID-19 seems to be higher. The rate of everybody who gets hospitalized have more severe disease as against influenza. We don't see that unless the strains are virulent on a year-by-year basis. We don't see it consistently. This is just started. So
yeah, well, and more. That's part of the tragedy of this pandemic that we're in, I think. And you, Dr. Raghunath, are kind of, as I was just saying, having to balance the research and the studies that go on with your frontline, you know, care to these patients. There was an article in the New York Times, which may or may not apply to you, but it was about how some frontline physicians are getting some pushback or having to balance the needs of data for patients that are in clinical trials to do things a certain way that kind of sometimes go against their gut instincts on what the patient is needing in the moment. Does this apply to you all here in Boone County, where you're having to address that balance as you look after patients?
Right. Clinical trials are conducted in a very controlled settings. And if we don't satisfy the criteria, it becomes really hard for that statistical model to interpret the results.
Yes.
So that's why it's important to hold on to what they are. It's always in the hands of the treating clinician. If he decides that this patient on a particular clinical trial would benefit from changing the approach a little bit, then that patient will be excluded from the trial. That is generally how we approach treatment for our patients. Our patients come first, no matter even if they are in the clinical trial. The only trial that we are doing right now is in convalescent plasma.
Yes.
Fortunately, remdesivir is supplied by the state, and we have enough supplies for our patients so right. far with the load that we have. The plasma is a relatively safe therapy and really not a lot of stringent rules for that, so we are able to conveniently provide it. We never had those dilemmas on. This particular treatment will exclude them from receiving other treatments. No, not really.
Yeah. Okay, great. That's good to hear. Dr. Raghunath, let's talk a little bit about vaccines. That's also been in the news this week with Russian vaccines in the news. Where do the vaccine trials here in the U.S. Stand from your point of view? And given what we know at this point, how optimistic are you that there will be a safe and effective vaccine available, as Dr. Fauci said, possibly in the first few months of next year? What do you think?
Right. Well, in the history of infectious diseases and pandemics, this is the fastest rate at which a vaccine has been developed. It's mainly because of the technology that they have. They're able to generate it in the lab. These are called mRNA viruses, messenger RNA virus, mRNA vaccines, not viruses. These vaccines have the genetic material essential to code the protein that is responsible for virus attachment to human cells, and they simulate just the production of the protein by giving them through a genetic material that's absorbed by human cells, and they produce these proteins simulating the virus, and body generates immunity. So we are entering phase three trials, which means we're trying it in larger human populations to see how safe it is, what doses are more safe and what doses are less safe. Really, what it is testing is to see if you're generating antibodies. So the antibody responses seem to be good so far, but really when it comes to how far is it going to protect you from natural infection depends on giving it more time to see with natural, when they come across a natural environment where they're exposed to the virus, whether it will confer protection or not, and how long the immunity lasts. That is a test of time. Even by this winter, if we have this phase three trial, some preliminary results, because we have started it now, I'm seeing in the news and everywhere that in last week of July and first week of August, we've moved on to phase three with the Moderna vaccine. And if those results are available even by November, December, only by waiting more time, we will know if they are sustainable responses. The lab research-related response does not essentially correlate into protection for the entire population. The behavior will be known only by giving it time and allowing it to pass through the natural exposures.
All right. Dr. Hari Raghunath, thank you so much for joining us. Only time will tell, as you say. We hope you'll come back and join us on the check-in again. In the meantime, thanks for all you do. Please stay safe and take care.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, bye-bye. It's a pleasure. Bye-bye. That's it for this week's check-in. Thanks again to our You Don't Say producers and conversationalists, Ms. Barbara Harrell, Mr. Jim Witt, and Reverend Clyde Ruffin. Thanks to the Como 200 Task Force for commissioning that You Don't Say Conversations. Again, you can go to como200.com to see more about our bicentennial plans for the city. Thanks also to Dr. Hari Raghunath for joining us. The check-in is produced by Christopher Husted. Congratulations, by the way, to the Husted Dresser House on the arrival of a new baby. Our crew is also led by news director Ryan Familiner. We also get help from producers Zia Kelly, Hannah France, and Olivia Moses. I'm Janet Saidi. We will be back next Thursday, same time and same place. You can also podcast the check-in, any of our episodes at kbia.org. I'm Janet Saidi. See you next Thursday. Until then, stay well and stay in touch.